And it is 8:30. We have here in the studios with us once again, and during the next 30 minutes, it is none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State.
What was that music?
That was still Leo Kottke.
I think Mike pushed the wrong button on the CD player.
No, I pushed the right button. I just didn't advance to the proper track.
Well, it was very nice.
It was a little mellower than what we're used to.
Some people might like that.
Yeah,
they might. They might.
Yeah, they you know, want to ease into the gentle 30 minutes of uplifting news about the world that we do present each week.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So we're just trying to help with the transition.
It's the little feel-good half hour of Eat the Airwaves.
Yeah. It's kind of a snack on the airwaves.
Yeah.
Our fast food for thought.
There we go.
So
not fast food. Good food served fast.
Okay. And consumed even quicker.
Yes.
Let's dive into it, shall we? It was a very busy week for both nationally and internationally, starting out with the UN Weapons Inspectors reports that happened on Monday.
Yeah, and it happened and it disappeared in the media really quickly. So
I want to review it.
Just want to review it this morning. That on Monday, the two chief weapons inspectors made their reports to the UN Security Council. Hans Blix, he basically said that there was no evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but that Iraq is not actively complying. And the way that he put it was they're cooperating on process but not on substance, by which he meant process being that they were giving all access to various sites to the weapons inspectors, but in regards to substance, that they haven't provided evidence that all of their chemical and biological weapons were destroyed. So essentially he fell into the U.S. camp by trying to argue that because Iraq has not produced any evidence that they have any chemical or biological weapons, therefore they're guilty, a pretty dubious claim. It was interesting because after his report...
It's basically a statement that Iraq has failed, in fact, to prove the negative that the United States is demanding they prove.
Right, right. And it's interesting, too, that after his report, he assured reporters over and over again that I have not caved into U.S. pressure on my report, you know. And it was interesting because here in the U.S., the two reports that were made, one by Hans Blix and one by Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the nuclear inspectors in Iraq, it was reported in the U.S. press that these were profoundly or fundamentally negative reports, when in fact the rest of the world pretty much reported it as positive reviews, and were shocked that Hans Blix made such strange and very negative opinions, gave such strange and very negative opinions in his report about Iraqi compliance. So it's kind of interesting if you read the British press or the French press agency or other news sources around the world, the difference in the way this was reported versus here. So I just want to go over what Mohammed El-Baradei had to say.
Can I just a brief thing to that also in terms of what was missing in reports here, that there wasn't any acknowledgement in reports here that the nature of the reports from either of the gentlemen could at all have been political. You know, the idea
right.
here was that these were authoritative reports unstained by the political process, such as, for example, pressure from the United States government. Mm-hmm. Whereas that's assumed in the rest of the world in its press reports that this is part of a political process.
Right, and Blix was very careful to say, you know, oh, I just report the facts. I just give you what we found, and the Security Council gets to decide what to do and gets to put the spin on it, when it was quite obvious, and some of the Security Council member nations were shocked by this, that Blix actually gave his opinion and gave it very strongly and did not leave it just to the Security Council to put spin on it. He put his own spin on it, and that spin was very close to the U.S.'s spin on the situation. So I just want to go over what Mohammed El-Baradei had to say, because his report was hardly covered anywhere. Baradei basically said that there was no evidence of nuclear activity in Iraq, that the International Atomic Energy Agency is monitoring Iraq's rivers, canals, and lakes, because, you know, you need water for cooling the fuel rods if you have a nuclear power plant. And there would therefore be traces of radioactivity in water bodies, and there was none. That inspectors had interviewed scientists, managers, and technicians in their workplaces, and you know, here we've been led to believe by the media and the Bush administration that no interviews are taking place, and that that therefore is one of the demands being made. Well, interviews are taking place. They're just not taking place outside of the country. The Bush administration thinks that if you export Iraqi scientists, they'll be more forthcoming. But that in itself is a problem, because then they leave behind family members who can be used as pressure on them. So Baraday had stressed that interviews were taking place in workplaces and that scientists had been pretty forthcoming. That inspectors inspected all the buildings and sites that the U.S. and Britain had identified as having been under construction or as suspicious sites, and that they had found nothing there. That he talked about the aluminum tubes not being suited at all for use in nuclear centrifuges, and that, that both the size and the composition of the tubes were all wrong, and that they were probably being used to for conventional missiles, as Iraq had claimed. He said also that Iraq had provided all the documents. They had provided all the documents that the inspectors had requested. So how, I mean, can you comply more? I mean, Blix had said that, and Baraday says this at the end of his report, that Iraq could be more forthcoming if they gave us material we hadn't requested. That's essentially the only way that they have not complied, that they haven't come forward and said, well, here's all this other stuff we haven't given you that we just suddenly found or something. But if they have been serious in surrendering information to the inspectors, they wouldn't be finding much of that stuff on their own. So there's really no evidence that they haven't been complying, in other words. So Baraday's report was profoundly positive for Iraq, and it consequently didn't get reported here at all, hardly. But it also his report also contained a couple of other very important points. He stressed that the inspectors need more information from UN member states, and that was in particular a poke at the United States and at Britain, who have said that they have definitive evidence, but the evidence they've been giving the inspectors has not led them to find anything, which makes the inspectors think, well, you're not giving us all the evidence you have, guys. Come on, you gotta tell us where this stuff is.
And then they also have not been forthcoming in terms of, you know, the United States and Britain have been alleging that Iraq has a number of materials. Where would have those materials have come from? And we saw some of that also in the original report that Iraq gave the Security Council, where the U.S. decided to go ahead and edit it. And
excise
one of,
those
and,
part,
and one
those
of the
parts.
Things that was excised was the parts that detailed the largely U.S. and British corporations, along with many others from Western Europe, that provided some of the particularly pre-Gulf War and also some post-Gulf War shipments that Iraq received of
dual-use
of
materials.
Dual-use materials.
Yeah. That's really been rubbing me wrong ever since I've heard that, the fact that there seems no interest in the media on following up on that. Well, they call, you know, Saddam a war criminal, and it's like, well, gee, who supplied him with this stuff? Wouldn't they be complicit in these war crimes? Why aren't the U.S. corporations that are on that the 24 that we know of, you know, being pursued?
Right. Right. So. No, that's something that's very important to him. He also specifically mentioned that the U.S. and Britain are continuing to say that Iraq has been trying to get a hold of uranium from Africa since 1991, but have provided no evidence to the inspectors. And he said, look, we can look for that material in Iraq. We can try to trace that material, but we need the evidence. Can you give it to us? And so far, Britain and the U.S. have not provided that evidence to the inspectors.
And the uranium in Africa comes from South Africa, and who controls South Africa's uranium?
Supposedly South Africa had stopped their nuclear program when the apartheid era ended. So if Iraq had been trying to get that from South Africa, it would have had to have been a while ago.
Yeah, it would have had to have been at a time when the South African government and that program was very closely allied with the United States program.
Yeah, exactly. And so the second point that Al Baraday made in his report that I think is a very important point is he stressed the value of the inspection process. And he pretty much closed his report with this point, that the inspectors destroyed Iraq's nuclear program in the 1990s when they were there. and so they prevented Iraq from building a nuclear weapon, and that inspectors now, currently in Iraq, are preventing them through their monitoring and their presence at various facilities, are preventing Iraq from gearing up a new nuclear program. And he stressed the importance of that. Now, he's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and that's what the IAEA does, is that they inspect and they verify that nations are complying with non-proliferation agreements and are not producing nuclear weapons.
And let's emphasize that once again, because what that means is that the report is saying that Iraq not only does not have weapons of mass destruction, but that they can be prevented in the future from having weapons of mass destruction, which is the United States' rationale for invading Iraq. So what we have is, if you treat war as a last resort rather than a first resort, this is a way to accomplish the goal that the United States says it wants without resorting to war.
It's to continue to allow the inspectors to do their job.
Yes, to continue to allow, the United States has been trying to undermine those inspections as well. But mm-hmm. if the inspections go forward and that program goes forward without interference from the United States and Britain, that will accomplish the goal that the Bush administration says is the rationale for invading Iraq. The problem with the United States policy is that it is a conclusion, which is to say invading Iraq, that is in search of rationale for a conclusion, and that's a conclusion that uses war as a first resort rather than a last resort.
Mm-hmm. Or it's simply saying that, the inspections are of no value, and so we need to go immediately to war because that is the last resort. We've tried everything. Well, no, Baradei was saying that the inspection process is succeeding, and it is of value, and the U.S. is wrong on that point, which I thought was very important.
Yeah, and that sensibility also is shared by most of the rest of the world, that the inspections are, in fact, valuable and are, in fact, working.
Mm-hmm. So on Tuesday, we had Bush's State of the Union address, which I suppose many people listening to this program heard or have read excerpts from, where he tried to make his rationale to go to war with Iraq and essentially appealed to our mission from God, invade Iraq. He didn't have a whole lot of evidence that he produced other than the same old argument, Iraq may have these chemical and biological weapons that they said they destroyed but have no proof that they destroyed, and until they provide us proof that they destroyed them, then they must have them.
Yeah, we mentioned that in passing, and I think progressives and leftists tend to take it as something as a joke. I don't want to go into it in a whole lot of detail here. The current column that's up at workingforchange.com explores it more. But that whole idea that it's a mission for God is, I think, much more important to the Bush administration than the progressive wing of the anti-war movement gives it credit for. You know, we're really talking about manifest destiny or white man's burden and this sensibility that, you know, the United States is uniquely endowed by a mission from God, that it is, you know, really the chosen people and the chosen land, and that it is our right to pass judgment on the rest of the world, particularly that part of the world that does not believe as we do. And it really is, I think, a powerful part of the motivation and of the sensibility that you know, treats not just the invasion of Iraq, but the whole idea of American empire, that we have the right to pass judgment on and invade and replace governments anywhere in the world. That is an important thing to understand, I think, when looking at this is coming from.
In that sense, it puts us in the same camp as the Taliban.
Very, very much so.
Yeah, he didn't seem to present too much evidence that it was our mission from God.
Well, yeah, bear in mind,
stated it.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden, yeah, it's a matter of faith. Osama bin Laden and the Taliban were conspicuously missing from the State of the Union in terms of whether they were mentioned. I mean, that was only, 16 months ago, but you would think it was in another generation's from how little attention it actually got as part of this quote-unquote war on terror. But you could hear Osama bin Laden's voice in the rationale for this current war. It was very, very present.
Well, and I'm pretty sure when they did some of those sweeps of the audience, I saw him up in one of the upper seats. So.
Clapping. Yeah, clapping a lot.
In amongst the speechwriters.
Yeah.
So on Wednesday, so late Tuesday and early Wednesday, you have the members of the UN Security Council coming out of a meeting where they discussed the reports provided by the UN weapons inspectors, and 11 of 15 members of the UN Security Council were still against the war. This is after the inspectors gave their reports and after Bush gave his State of the Union address. 11 of 15 members of the Security Council, the four that were not were, I believe, Spain and Bulgaria, two very highly dependent client states of the United States, receive a lot of aid from us, Britain and the U.S. Those were the four that were for war. But Tony Blair was counseling a go-slow approach, which is entirely against what George Bush wants. And the opinion
polls...
And
that's the one military partner of the United States for
this. The one major military partner. And the opinion polls here at home had barely blipped up in support of Bush's war policy. So it was announced, and this was announced during Bush's State of the Union address, but also announced widely on Wednesday, that Colin Powell would present evidence, hard evidence, of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction to the UN next week, next Wednesday. So on Thursday, there was lots of discussion over what that evidence would be, and there was there were furious meetings amongst intelligence officials in the Bush administration.
Make it up.
Trying to figure out what they could declassify and what they could put together as hard proof of Iraqi noncompliance and material breach of the UN resolution. So I just wanted to go over some of the stuff that might be presented on Wednesday. The mobile bioweapons lab evidence, which comes from three unnamed Iraqi defectors and hasn't been independently verified, including some satellite photos of very big trucks, which might not be convincing to people who know what very big trucks can be used for. Some other evidence that might be provided include Iraq trying to buy uranium from Africa. We already talked about that. That comes from British intelligence, but they have provided no specific details. We might see some more details on that one. Again, I don't think it is a recent attempt because, you know, I mean,
well,
if they were going to buy it from South Africa, they would have had to have bought it when South Africa was producing it, which was quite a while ago.
But an attempt to buy and to purchase are like two different things.
Yeah, the ability to acquire versus the attempt to buy, that's another question. Some other evidence they might provide is more about the stupid aluminum tubes, which Bush again mentioned in his State of the Union address, even though the UN inspector, Mohammed El-Baradei, said that they were not suited for the nuclear centrifuges. I think the Bush administration has a hard time changing tack on that one. They're going to keep mentioning these stupid aluminum tubes, even though they're not real evidence. They're going to talk about links to Al-Qaeda, which are based on one member of Al-Qaeda who passed through Baghdad and got some medical treatment on his way to Jordan. That's the one piece of evidence they have. They may also mention Ansar al-Islam, a group that is a fundamentalist Kurdish group that operates in the northern part of Iraq, which is not under the control of Saddam Hussein. And the head of Ansar al-Islam came out on Friday and said, "I'm sorry, folks, but I've had no contact at all with Saddam Hussein or the Iraqi government. In fact, he's living in Norway as a political dissident who is in exile because Saddam Hussein has been trying to get rid of Ansar al-Islam." So the Bush administration is going to try to say that they, because they have connections to Al-Qaeda, also have connections to Saddam Hussein, and that is ridiculous. The other evidence includes satellite photos of Iraq cleaning up what the U.S. thinks are weapon sites, particularly bulldozers operating on those sites, just prior to inspectors arriving there, although inspectors have said that those sites are actually dumps where Iraq gets rid of its old and obsolete conventional weapons, and that the bulldozers are simply burying those weapons.
Which is their routine mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is their routine mission. And again, photos of the very large trucks, which could be carrying anything. I have to admit,
and which you still can't use on, you know, heavily potholed roads to handle sensitive bioweapons.
Right, and I can't imagine you getting any kind of serious biocontainment in the back of a refrigerated truck. I simply can't imagine that. Biocontainment labs are usually rooms within rooms within rooms with negative air pressure. You have to wear bio suits when you visit them, and I can't imagine.
And large
that.
Staffs also,
right? And I can't imagine that happening in the back of like a U-Haul or a refrigerated truck. So that's some of the evidence they'll provide.
Yeah. They may also
provide lists of some imported chemicals and dual-use items.
Yeah, there's also reports out that the U.S. is going to present monitored telephone conversations in which things like Iraqi officials saying, move this here or there, or we can't believe that they missed that. And, you know, among other things, this is the same sort of sourcing that was used to say we heard the voice of Osama bin Laden, which has never come forward. The United States has been pushing for months now for this war, and has been pushing very hard for it. And there have been demands for the quote-unquote smoking gun for a very long time. And so I really would caution people to take any evidence that is presented as the quote-unquote smoking gun with a heaping measure of salt, actually.
Yeah.
Particularly something like that, which is, you know, very frankly very easily faked.
The very last point I want to make is that yesterday it leaked out that some of the evidence Colin Powell will supply to the UN is based on these monitored conversations. Well, I want to just quote for you what was in the article I read. The quote is, quote, NSA has been closely monitoring the conversations of Iraqi officials ever since the United Nations weapons inspectors re-entered Iraq 2 months ago, end quote. Now, I kind of take that to mean that there may be some spying going on amongst the weapons inspectors, that there are probably some NSA officials or CIA people among the UN weapons inspection teams. And that tells me also why the Bush administration has been reluctant to release this kind of information. It may be because they don't want to compromise the fact and embarrass themselves and make themselves look like fools because they have once again included spies among the UN weapons inspectors.
Yeah,
that's
there's
my
a history
feel.
Of that.
That's my feel for it, and that's something that may come out on Wednesday when we see the actual evidence that Powell presents.
I'm sorry, can you read that one more time?
The quote is, NSA has been closely monitoring the conversations of Iraqi officials ever since the United Nations weapons inspectors re-entered Iraq 2 months ago.
Oh, so we weren't doing that for the last 12 years. They just started that 2 months ago.
Yeah, well, that
would be my question. I mean, if they just started that when the weapons inspectors re-entered, that would tell me, well, who's been placing the bugs so that they can do that.
Or alternatively, if you would expect that the telephone conversations were monitored by monitoring satellite transmissions, which is, you know, how Echelon, for example, works, then that would have been a continuous process that wouldn't have just started when the inspectors came into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, moving along, there were further developments related to our moves in the Middle East.
Yeah, while all this was going on, there were also a number of preparations for war, and you start wondering at this point. I mean, I've been very much of the belief that this war has not been a done deal for a very long time. I think, with the possible exception of government and public pressure, both internationally and domestically, there's not a lot that can avert this war right now. Simply because so much has been put into it, so much has been spent on it. We have well over 200,000 troops that are going to be in place very, very soon in the Middle East. We saw on Monday and Tuesday the Turkish government reverse course and say that it would allow U.S. troops to use its bases as part of a land invasion from the north. This was done with several billion, B as in billion dollars worth of inducements to the Turkish government. And you know that behind the scenes, one of the tremendous costs of this whole exercise, and that's something we really haven't heard much about, was just how much money is going to be spent on this whole invasion at a time when the deficit is ballooning enormously, and that's not even counting the cost of replacing all of the munitions that we're going to be firing. You know that behind the scenes, diplomatically, part of the arm twisting that's going on to try and not even at this point line up international support for an invasion, but try and get governments not to object too strenuously to the invasion. That's going to be a very expensive proposition. But the and another important development, of course, that was not really focused on very much because it happened at the same time in the State of Union was the elections in Israel, in which the Likud party won really what it will consider an overwhelming mandate for its use of force against Palestinians in parliamentary elections there. What that means is that at the time of any U.S. invasion of Iraq, it's virtually a given that, similar to the invasion of Afghanistan last year, the Israeli government is likely to use the diversion of the world's attention toward an invasion of Iraq as a way to launch a new offensive against the Palestinians living on the West Bank and probably this time Gaza. And that's combined with the likelihood that there will be widespread throughout the Islamic world and certainly among Palestinians probably demonstrations and objections and probably terrorist campaigns and actions objecting to the U.S. invasion, the U.S. and Israel being very closely tied in the minds of most of the Islamic world. So you had those very disturbing developments. You also had the release of, and this was done partially last week, and then some additional details on it came out this week, information on how the United States intends to invade Iraq. And it's very, very sobering stuff. There were TV interviews last week with a guy named Harlan Ullman, U-L-L-M-A-N, and John Pilger in his column in the Daily Mirror in Britain had a very good column on this. Again, you have to go to the British press to find out some of this. It's at www.mirror.co.uk.
That's our website. Site of the week.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good week.
People should be coming to listen to our program with a pen and paper so you can write down the website of the week.
Yeah, very much so. But he came out with the details of, he's apparently the primary military strategist who's helped develop the plan on how to invade Iraq. And it involves land invasions from both the north and the south, and at the same time an air attack against Baghdad, the capital itself, with a strategy that is called shock and awe. And this is a strategy that's very similar to what was used to force the Japanese to surrender in 1945 by the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the idea being that the force used will be so overwhelming and so dispiriting to the Iraqi people, if not the Iraqi government, that they'll just throw up their hands and stop fighting, and the Iraqi armed forces will stop fighting and you know, fall apart in disarray, and the war essentially will be over.
Or everybody will be dead.
And that's what I want to get to, is that the specifics behind shock and awe are the idea that the United States will drop approximately 800 cruise missiles on the city of Baghdad. That's the entire city, the entire civilian population of a city of about 4 million people in the space of 2 days. Now, that's more munitions that were dropped during the entire Gulf War, which in turn were more munitions.
Which stretched over 40 days.
Which stretched over 40 days. And that in turn was more munitions that were dropped during World War II. I mean, we're talking about a tremendous firepower. And I have a direct quote from Mr. Ullman during his TV interview last week that, quote, you have this simultaneous effect, rather like the nuclear weapons of Hiroshima, where we're talking not days or weeks, but minutes in terms of the cumulative effect. And what we're also talking is the probable death of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians, and not just the immediate death, but also because of the decimation of already weakened public health and emergency facilities, probably the slow lingering death. You have essentially a firestorm effect where they suck all of the air, all of the oxygen out of the air throughout Baghdad, so that shelters are of no help in a situation like that because you can't breathe. And so when you hear Donald Rumsfeld and you hear people in the Pentagon and at the White House talking about the United States exercising extreme care to avoid civilian casualties, that's not what they're planning. What they're planning is a wholesale slaughter. What they're planning is a war crime of the type that we have not seen really in a very, very long time in any kind of an invasion.
If ever.
You know, we're talking of firestorm.
Understand, we're not at war with Iraq. We were at war with Japan. We're not at war with Iraq. So this is on, I think, a level that is way above dropping the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is
an unprovoked attack still. I mean, even though the United States has been talking about it for a very long time, Iraq has never attacked the United States. Iraq poses no military threat to the United States.
And according
None.
To the UN weapons inspectors, poses no terrorist threat either.
And not only poses no threat now, but does not have the foreseeable capacity to at any time in the foreseeable future. And so what you have essentially is an unprovoked attack of staggering proportions. You have something like Hiroshima or Dresden, but with 60 years of additional technology mixed in. That's what the United States is talking about right now. And not only is it a war crime in and of itself, but it is likely to provoke a reaction from the rest of the world, particularly the Islamic world, that guarantees war against the United States and terrorist attacks for years to come.
Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State.
Your cheerful thought for the week.
Yeah, maybe you can play some of that nice, soothing music again, Mike.
No, nothing's going to help that, and it shouldn't. Tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State is a biweekly newspaper. You can find it around town in Seattle in free places at bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants, anywhere you find free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer for our all-volunteer publication, you can call us at 206-903-9461.